Hello, and welcome to the 18th episode of the Global History Podcast. I'm Chase, your host for today's segment, and today I'm happy to welcome to the podcast Rachel Kaufman, a rising second-year graduate student in the Department of History at UCLA. In her own words, Rachel works on Latin American and Jewish history. Her current research focuses on crypto-Jewish memory practices in New Mexico and Mexico from the late 15th century to the 20th century. She is the author of the article Translating History, published in Rethinking History, the Journal of Theory and Practice, in 2020. Her Yale senior essay, entitled Whispered Tradition, New Mexico Crypto-Jewish Memory, Origins to 2007, was published in the Yale Historical Review in spring of 2019. Rachel is also a contributing editor at the Journal for the History of Ideas blog, where she has contributed pieces about her work. Her poetry has appeared in multiple publications, including but not limited to Juxta Prose, The Raw Art Review, Carve Magazine, and Southwestern American Literature. In September of 2020, before both of us started our PhD program in history at UCLA, I spoke with Rachel over Skype about her work on crypto-Judaism in the New World, the complexities of memory practices, and the importance of poetry for translating the emotions and materiality of the historical archive. Listen on to find out more. If you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And just a note to say that if you're listening to this on our website, we're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts if you'd prefer to listen on one of these platforms. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the podcast. So thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure to read your work and your undergraduate senior essay, as well as your various other pieces and your poetry. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much. So usually I'd like to ask about the guest's personal background at the end of the interview as a way of wrapping up in a way. But I think that since we're talking about memory, I think in some ways it would be quite a good place to start with your own personal experience. So I was wondering if I could please ask you to start off, what led to your interest in these kind of entangled histories, the history of Judaism in the New World, this idea of memory, of crypto-Jewish memory, as well as historical poetry, and kind of how did your project evolve as you moved through various archives and libraries and places?
Definitely. So I began my study of history and literature really through the Holocaust and German history. I did some work as an undergrad on Holocaust poetry, both of the generation of survivors and the second generation. Actually, the way I got from Germany to Spain was also through poetry, through medieval Hebrew poetry in Muslim Spain. So my introduction to the Iberian Peninsula was really through language. But then I became fascinated in Spanish memory as it related to the Holocaust and the 20th century, to Franco's regime and the Spanish Civil War. And so spent a summer working at La Real Academia de Bellas Artes in Madrid. And while I was there, I didn't do archival work. It wasn't sort of on my mind at the time, but I did do a lot of traveling around to different memorial sites, trying to get a sense of sort of the surfacings of memory culture as they stood in, you know, 2016 in relation to the past, and just found that endlessly fascinating. And then for my senior thesis, I decided I wanted to study something in the Americas. And it was just suggested to me, there's this wealth of scholarship being done on crypto Jews in New Mexico over the past two decades. Maybe you would find it interesting. And then traveled to New Mexico, fell in love with the Southwest landscape as a poet, as a person, and also as a historian. And so everything sort of just evolved from there. And I did my archival research at the University of New Mexico's their Center for Southwest Research, and then at the American Jewish Historical Society, the Center for Jewish History in New York City. And both archives gave me different things, but I wasn't expecting to study the memory practices of crypto Jews or to come to sort of the conclusions that I came to. But these patterns in memory work surfaced so resolutely in a surprising way. So then the scholarship sort of emerged and my work became sort of more transnational and interested in that act of migrating as a historian and watching the migration of peoples.
Well, thank you so much for starting us off with that recollection. It's so fascinating how your research, it didn't necessarily start off and end as the same thing. It underwent this journey, which I think is a really, really interesting example of how scholarly process works. So now I'd like to ask you a bit more about this senior essay, which I think was really fascinating, and I think I'd like to focus on that today. So I'd like to ask you a bit about the historical context for your study. So I think your study kind of begins with an introduction looking at this kind of late medieval evolution of Judaism and attitudes and practices, or rather policies towards Judaism in the peninsula, in the Iberian Peninsula. And I was wondering if you just could briefly speak about some of the major events in this late medieval history, and how they kind of contributed to the formation of a Jewish diaspora.
Definitely. So it begins, and I think this is how the thesis begins, with this naming of Sepharad, which is a term that originates in the Bible, and then by the Middle Ages is sort of synonymous with Spain proper. And it's sort of a site of Jewish cultural identity formation, of Muslim cultural identity formation, and is associated with a term that has been unpacked and repacked across a long period of time, convivencia, or coexistence, which is a sort of semi-mythical term which refers to the peaceful coexistence of Christians, Muslims, and Jews in Spain, starting with the 8th century, the Muslim conquest of Hispania, through 1492, the expulsion of the Jews. And so along the way, of course, there was great cultural production, great artistic production. I mentioned that I came to the Iberian Peninsula through its medieval poetry, its Hebrew medieval poetry. But of course, violence and oppression traversed this coexistence as well. So skipping from the 8th century to closer to the exile, 1391 was an important year in this history, a year of pogroms, of conversions and violence, which led to, or it's thought to have sort of marked as the moment when Nuevo Cristianos emerged, this idea of new Christians, because a mass number of Jews were converted, and so a new identity group emerged. And then following this sort of initial conversion, the distrust that had previously been held for Jews was now held towards these new Christians, because of sort of a new statute, not new in creation, but maybe new in name, of limpieza de sangre, or purity of blood, that these new Christians were markedly not old Christians. And so this led to the creation of the Spanish Inquisition in 1478, the decree of Alhambra in 1492. And that sort of final decree said, if you have not already converted Jews to being a new Christian, you must convert or you must be expelled. So this led to the mass movement, if it had not already occurred, because of course there was diaspora prior, but a mass sort of Sephardic diaspora to the Ottoman Empire, primarily to North Africa, and then also to the New World, to the Americas.
It's a very interesting, and I think a painful history as well. And I was wondering if you could speak to me, perhaps we'll leave the conversation about the Ottoman Empire to another time, but I was curious if we could focus on the New World here. Why did new Christians, or people who were descended from Jews, move to the New World in the early modern period? What kind of attraction was there? We kind of talked about the push factors, but what kind of pull factors were there? And in particular, you looked at New Mexico, or what we today call New Mexico. Once people arrived in the New World, what kind of brought them to these kind of northern frontier areas of the Spanish Empire?
So I think the New World attraction primarily maybe was distance. It seemed because there had been some sort of smaller diasporas beforehand. Some people went from Spain to Portugal, and of course that didn't work out. So I think there was this notion that we're moving really far away, which of course was not so successful, since the Spanish Inquisition set up an office in Mexico City in 1571. Along with that idea was colonial opportunity, and that a lot of conversos traveled to the New World on conquistador ships. There are examples of, I think it's 80-something conversos traveling with Columbus. It's recorded that they were on his ship. And then Luis de Carvajal, who's a very infamous governor. He was the governor of Nuevo León, and received that position in 1571, which is the same year the Inquisition in Mexico was set up. And he took along many members of his family, even though, of course, you were not supposed to, if you were a converso, be able to board a ship to the New World. So it was sort of an act of smuggling, but many managed to do it. And then once conversos were in Mexico, as I mentioned, the Inquisition followed them. So again, in my research, both, and it's not the easiest historical work to do, and I think you see this in a lot of the scholarship, that it's pretty hard to trace these motivations, especially with the records that we have. But again, colonial opportunity sort of pushed people from Mexico into more northern territories in what's now the U.S. Southwest, including Luis de Carvajal, who traveled north and colonized. So that's sort of the general migration line.
I think that's so fascinating. And you mentioned records, and I'd like to ask you a little bit about this. We'll come to memory in just a moment as a kind of historical methodology or even object of study. You can tell me much more about this. But just briefly, when thinking about these Inquisition records, what kind of traces of the crypto-Jews do we have in these records? How does Judaism, or I suppose new Christians as well, how do they show up in the sources? How can we glimpse them in the inquisitorial archive?
Definitely. They're really fascinating and rich sources that many scholars have made use of in different ways across the decades, maybe centuries, maybe decades. And the documents are really fascinating in terms of religious and cultural, as religious and cultural artifacts, and are really valuable in finding micro historical moments of the past. The documents, of course, are written under oath. They're legal documents, and they're written, the witnesses are being recorded. They know that they're being recorded. And also, of course, there are issues of scribal accuracy of the person who is transcribing the words being spoken at these alto de fe trials. But you can glimpse, and this is what a lot of the scholarship has done, a lot of the crypto-Jewish practices. You can see across time sort of the distillation of Judaism as rituals are condensed and distilled and lost or transformed, blended with forms of Christianity or Catholicism in the New World. And you also see family relationships. You see that the Inquisition trials have emphasized lineage, as makes sense, and so have these extensive family trees sketched into them. So you can really map sort of social cultural worlds through the trials.
I think that's so fascinating, and definitely, as you say, very difficult sources to use, but I think a real wealth of information. And I think this is perhaps true across different historical places and some times of study. These ideas of court records are quite interesting as source materials. So now moving forward in time to this kind of core of your thesis, this kind of, I don't want to use the term modern exactly, but more retrospective memories of these earlier experiences. I was curious, over time, so moving beyond the Inquisition records, what types of sources do we have to study this evolving crypto-Jewish community in New Mexico in particular, all the way up to the present? And I suppose I would ask, what do different genres of source material tell us? For example, a newspaper versus an oral history, or as you said, an Inquisition record versus, say, a letter. And I was wondering if you could comment on this kind of body of source materials over time.
Yeah. So there's a sort of a point of contention amongst scholars, which maybe we'll get to when we talk about memory versus history, I imagine, and that there's sort of a gap in source material following 1821, following Mexico's independence from Spain and the end of the Inquisition, because the records disappear, the trials are no longer taking place. And I think we'll get to this later, but I found a newspaper from 1889 from Mexico called El Sábado Secreto, or The Secret Sabbath, which is written by and for conversos and sort of for an imagined, possibly also real in logistical 19th century ways, larger Sephardic sort of global audience. So that's a really interesting material in that it was written for the public. It's a newspaper with a sort of a political purpose, with a construction, a cultural construction and revitalization purpose, which I read very differently from the texts that also enter the thesis, which are sort of later 20th century, even 21st century documents written by crypto Jews living in New Mexico. And those documents are sometimes public. There are exhibitions, there's poetry that's published, there's artwork that's hung on the wall. And then there's also in the, one of the things I love about the Center for Southwest Research at UNM is the wealth of intimate materials of sort of the private domestic, often written by women. It's pretty well discussed that women were often the purveyors of crypto-Jewish identity, of those Jewish rituals that were being secretly transmitted from generation to generation. And so those poems and family trees and scribblings, there's an amazing collection of the work of Emma Moya, who's a crypto Jew living in New Mexico, who has just this extensive and eclectic collection of all sorts of newspaper clippings, and her interests span all the way from Sephardi to the Holocaust to Native American studies to Southwestern studies. And so that eclecticism was actually became a real point of interest in the work.
That's really fascinating. I'd like to return to that eclecticism a bit later when we speak more about memory. I'd just like to ask you briefly about the literature that's been written about this group over time, because I think you make some really interesting critiques of this literature in your work. And in particular, I was very interested, you mentioned the passing down of Jewish customs, and I was interested, there seems to be this, not obsession, but definitely a persistent debate in the literature that you kind of critique about the so-called authenticity of the Jewishness of this group, or their lineage or practices. Are they really Jewish, in scare quotes? And I personally think that you come up with a very strong alternative to this in your discussion of memory. But I was wondering if you could briefly speak about why were 20th and I suppose some 21st century scholars interested in this group, and why was there such a focus on authenticity?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so there was this interesting phenomenon, which is slightly mythical in detail, that Stanley Hordes, or Hordes, who was the New Mexico state historian, became interested in sort of these traces of New Mexican crypto-Jewish identity, finding crosses and Jewish stars on gravestones in the Southwest. The sort of mythical part, but I'm sure it was true. I'm interested in this construct of myth anyway, which is perhaps outside the scope of this conversation, but that people would sort of knock on the door and whisper, oh, I have an heirloom. I have a secret that was told to me by my mother or my grandmother. I have this ritual object. I have this ritual tradition that has been passed down to me that I named Catholicism, not really knowing that it was different, but not knowing much more than that. So he sort of initiated this newfound interest in crypto-Judaism in the Southwest, which has led to a large amount of scholarship, often debating, as you say, this idea of authenticity. So on the one hand, you have Stanley Hordes, who says this can be historically traced through these traces, for lack of a better word. And then Seth Kunin, who's a really interesting scholar who distinguishes between historical and cultural authenticity. And I end up sort of taking him up on his idea of cultural authenticity rather than historical. And on the opposing side, you have someone like Judith Newlander, who sort of dives into the genealogical side, dives into sort of more a fact-finding approach, perhaps, to history, which I try to say not disparagingly, because it has its merits, which says this, you know, that we cannot trace continuity of crypto-Jewish identity because we don't have the source materials, and also makes the argument that this is not a diluted form of Judaism, but is a diluted form of Christianity with sort of elements of Judaism within it. So I acknowledge that sort of debate, but I choose not to enter it just because of my interest. And there is, I just want to mention, there's this new book called The Conversos Return by Dalia Candiotti, that was just published by Stanford, I think, in the last year or maybe the last month. Actually, and she sort of has a similar claim of, well, there are debates about historical authenticity. And actually, Carrie Hertz does this too, who's the photographer who writes this sort of foundational book documenting New Mexico crypto-Judaism, that I'm not going to enter the historical discussion. I'm interested in something else. which is interesting in of itself, that sort of that excuse has to be explicitly laid out, or that claim has to be made explicit. But that's sort of the scholarship that's existing, although I mentioned this new book, which is a comparative literature, a more literature-focused book, perhaps is doing something similar to what my work is trying to do. But that's where it stood. And so that was sort of my jumping off point.
That's really fascinating. Thank you. And I forget who said this. It was not about Judaism. It was about modernity. It might have been Christopher Bailey, but it was this idea of it's important to think about when people claim that they're modern, we have to kind of think about the fact that it matters that they believe they are. Meaning that sometimes what people believe about themselves is in itself an interesting object of study and important to consider. Not that truth and veracity of certain lineages is not important, you're right. It's just that you're asking different sorts of questions. So I think that brings us quite nicely to memory. And I'd like to ask a methodological question. I was really fascinated by this particular statement in your essay. It's a little long, but I think it's worth kind of repeating in full because I think it's a very rich statement. You write that, quote, contemporary New Mexico crypto Jews must craft their identities out of memory, personal and familial, but they must also string these memories together in order to create a continuous and whole Jewish identity. By threading together disparate events onto one string of identity, New Mexico crypto Jews are not distorting the historical truth of each event, they are instead crafting new relationships between events. Crucially, this narrative does not exist in history, but in perception, in memory. So I think that there's a lot there, and I was wondering if you could unpack this for me. Especially, I'm very interested, and you alluded to this earlier, the kind of, there are some, of course they're related, but there are some important differences between history and memory as kind of, not only objects of study or subjects of study, but also as methodologies in and of themselves. So I was wondering if you could speak about this methodological statement that you've made.
Yeah, I think if it's okay, I would love to use an example to sort of assist my answer. This is from the thesis, and it's also from Carrie Hertz, who I mentioned previously, who's a photographer and created this book, New Mexico's Crypto Jews, Image and Memory, in I believe 2007. And she includes a New Mexican crypto Jew, Joe Roybal Izay, who writes of her grandfather's burial ceremony in 1947. And I'm just going to read excerpts of this sort of oral historical account. So Izay writes, "In prayer, minutes after his last breath, preparations to purify the body with hot water began immediately, and all mirrors were turned to the wall." And then it continues. So those are Jewish traditions that are common in crypto-Jewish narratives, turning the mirrors to the wall in mourning, preparing the body in a specific way. The Kaddish was recited. Everyone left the room. Early that evening, the penitentes, who led all Christian ceremonies, arrived and began praying and chanting. And I'll step in again to say the Penitente Brotherhood was a confraternity of Catholics in New Mexico, but Penitente also refers to those who were forced to perform public penitence during the Inquisition. So it carries both sort of a contemporary meaning and a meaning that attaches to the Inquisition. So they arrived and began praying. El hermano mayor, the leader, placed a yellow collar around my padrecito's shoulders. This item is called a San Benito. History tells us that in Sefarad, Spain, the heretics, Jews, and those are her insertions, had to wear a hooded yellow San Benito signifying they were heretics. This was the badge of shame. The Jews walked past the crowded streets where the pious Catholics cheered and jeered. Slowly, the Jews made their way to the stakes and into the burning fire. So I use her as an example because I think this is one of sort of the most poignant sources that demonstrates the distinction I'm trying to make between memory and history as methods, as you're saying, in that her quotation stands against, pretty starkly against, someone like Netanyahu, who wrote a book which sort of strung together the Inquisition and the Holocaust. And it said it was sort of through a rearview mirror, these sort of continuities that he was insisting upon. And that sort of distortion, which lives within the realm of historical claims and historical research, I think stands different in intention, different in consequence, in scope, from the memory work, the memory practices, and the patterns of memory practice that I found, and again, I wasn't searching for it, really rose from the texts amongst crypto Jews, which is the search for coherence and continuity within the familial, within the narratives that have been passed down through generations. And what I discovered was that this crypto-Jewish search in memory for coherence was necessary and crucial to a creation, a stable creation of collective memory and identity, because all that's passed down in crypto-Judaism is fragmentation. Just as the historian is faced with fragments, so too are the inheritors of this identity. So my argument in the quotation that you read is that Izay is not interested even in the careful recounting of historical information, in sort of contextualizing parallels, analogies across time, but that instead she's utilizing history as this emotional lever to demonstrate the injustice of her family's recent encounter with anti-Semitism, sort of adding the weight of a yellow collar was placed around my padrecito's shoulders, just as it was placed around my ancestors in Spain. And because this was from 1947, perhaps signaling also the yellow stars on Jewish lapels in Nazi Germany. So because she's sort of utilizing the past to stabilize and legitimize her cultural identity, and she's interested in learning about the past, but it's not from, it doesn't have the interest that maybe a historian would have in contextualization or in holding different moments, different sides of an analogy distinct and contextualized. It instead is sort of about image, about memory, about the sensorial, and it resides within the familial and is an act, a reparative act of what to do with an identity that has only rupture and fragment, and sort of how to create, how to make it whole.
I think it's a really beautiful example and definitely very poignant. And I don't know anything about this subject, but I would just point out from my own listening to you and my reading, it's so fascinating that this kind of emerges through a story about a funeral or burial practice, as in a very intensely emotional area in which perhaps this is where these types of hidden rituals did surface and did survive. But I'm not a specialist. So I'd like to ask you another aspect of memory, which I think I believe this is your second or third chapter. It's one of the central chapters where you speak about the symbol of la llave, so the key, which I think is a very interesting example. And I was wondering, for those who are unfamiliar, I was wondering if you could please speak about this myth of la llave, how it features in crypto-Jewish memory about their homeland and about Spain. And also, in a way, how it has been politicized in more recent years, which I thought was also very interesting to read.
Yes. So the myth of La Llave is the idea that when crypto-Jews or conversos fled Spain to go to their diasporic land, they took with them the key to their lost home in the hopes that they would one day return. So this myth comes to us in as little interpretations of actual keys, or of stories, sort of domestic, often kitchen stories, which is interesting, of the key being hidden in the kitchen cupboard or hidden in the drawer. And so this idea is prevalent in a lot of crypto-Jewish poetry that I read, which is my sort of main means into the myth, and also an exhibition in 1996, which was at a college in Albany, called Llave, A Key to the Secret, which held a lot of artifacts and also poetry. And this is actually another way to explain, I think, this distinction I'm making between memory and history. And I'll do this in a sort of roundabout way, but Svetlana Boym, who writes on nostalgia, distinguishes between reflective nostalgia and restorative nostalgia. And so restorative nostalgia, Boym writes, is about the return home, sort of the arrival back to the imagined homeland. And reflective nostalgia is an act of longing, and it's an act of dwelling in the act of remembering. And identity sort of exists within that process of remembering. So I argue that crypto-Jews' use of the myth of La Llave falls into this category of reflective nostalgia, of the process, the act of remembering itself, rather than a true desire to return, to take a flight to Spain and unlock a door. It's sort of more symbolic. On the other hand, The myth has also been utilized by the Spanish government in such examples as the right of return in 2015, of the law that was passed to invite descendants of Sephardic Jews, if they could trace their history and sometimes speak Ladino, sometimes speak no Spanish history, different interesting qualifications, that they could return to their homeland. And what I found in some of the examples that I cite is that this is a utilization of nostalgia that is not restorative, or I mean restorative in a different way. Restorative in that it restores identity, but reflective in the distinction I just made between the two types of nostalgia. It's not about dwelling in the process of remembering, but rather it's about rewriting history and sort of crafting a line of coherence with a political aim, which in this case I found is a means to absolution, of sort of rewriting Spain's involvement in the Holocaust history and Franco's treatment of Jewish refugees coming from Germany and Poland and countries to the east. Linhard, Tabea Linhard, writes a lot about this in her book Jewish Spain. So some of my work draws from her research. But the myth is a great example of how the same sort of, how the use of memory can be utilized for different purposes in different contexts, with different intentions, and how those processes are more important maybe than the content that they are distributing, because the content remains the same and everything else is different. And so perhaps there's different sort of ethical implications.
I think it's a really fascinating example in which this kind of memory can be materialized in this symbol in a way. So another thing I'd like to ask you, I know we spoke about your methodology regarding perhaps you're interested less in the actual lineage of people, whether they were connected in the past, more about what they believed, although you do acknowledge this is important. I was curious to ask specifically then, how would I phrase this, about the place of genealogy and of ideas about lineage in the memory of crypto-Jews in New Mexico and what this kind of serves. You mentioned that there's also quite a lot of interest in various members of the community, and I would add, I suppose, in a lot of different communities in the country, in genetic testing services, for example, like 23andMe or others, that claim to kind of tell you where you come from. And I was curious if you could kind of elaborate, I suppose, just what role does genealogy and lineage, whether imagined or I suppose even genetically tested, what can it tell us about how these links of memory are made through communities and families over time, regarding the crypto Jews in particular?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question. I think it sort of has the binary, but of course I'm saying binary knowing there's much in between that the myth of La Llave does, in intention and consequence. But genealogy, maybe to go back to the idea of cultural authenticity, of taking seriously how a group identifies and what's important to their collective identity. Definitely genealogy has surfaced in my research as important and gratifying for some, definitely not all, crypto Jews in New Mexico as a means of stability and restoration. On the other hand, the Spain's right of return also has these sort of weird genealogical implications of what is authentic identity, what is authentic Judaism or diaspora. It's rooted in some sort of genealogical, even biological sort of claim. And then I guess for my work too, if I focused more on genealogy, I would sort of maybe lose sight of the cultural memory, which I'm sort of giving more weight to, and I think the community is also giving more weight to as a means to sort of stable collective identity and memory. And then, just something interesting, there was an article, which I could pass along if I find it again, which pushes back on this idea of genealogical tracing in New Mexico, specifically of crypto Jews, in that someone, and I think it's not just someone, but the article was written by an individual, of course, but there's this idea that by claiming and or wanting to claim, if it is fictional, if an outsider thinks it's fictional, crypto-Jewish identity, one could perhaps be distancing themselves from their native roots or indigenous roots or roots in identity as a person of color and sort of seeking a whiteness and Iberian identity. And this is a really interesting topic in Sephardic studies. The work of Devin Na'ar talks a lot about this, the relationship between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews and whiteness and where that all falls. But that's an interesting example of how genealogy can sort of be manipulated, perhaps, as a means to claiming identities that are one's own, aren't one's own, but have very specific sort of political implications.
I think that's so fascinating. I'd love to read that article at some point. I think this brings up another area, which is, of course, the relationship, at least in memory or in imagination, or I suppose even in reality, although you might contest my division of these categories, mm-hmm. Between crypto-Jews and other, for example, Jewish communities or other communities who have undergone trauma, for example, in the 20th century. And I think you have a really interesting passage where you speak about, you use the term multidirectional memory, which I believe comes from a scholar, scholar's work, and you can speak about that. Can you please speak about the ways in which New Mexican Jews did participate in a multidirectional form of memory? And I think, for example, the Holocaust, which has appeared in our interview so far in a few places, is perhaps, in my reading, was a good example of groups identifying across the perceived boundaries of their own, say, identity. So I was wondering if you could speak about that.
Yeah, so multidirectional memory is a term that has been very dear to me from Michael Rothberg's text, Multidirectional Memory, Remembering the Holocaust in the Age of Decolonization. And now that I'm at UCLA, I can work with him because he's in the comparative literature department. And his idea was really formative to my work and my thinking even prior to the thesis. But his idea of multidirectional memory is that there should be sort of this intercultural interaction of historical memories in order to create a unified rather than disparate or competitive memory landscape. So individuals who practice multidirectional memory are working through the past, through their own traumas, the traumas of their communities, religion, religious or racial or ethnic, by connecting disparate histories and communities. So that idea, I think, is really powerful and pertinent in our moment. I know he's been talking a lot recently, and it applies to our current sort of reckoning with racial injustice in America, and how to place that reckoning in larger frameworks or not. And so what I discovered, I had that in the back of my head, of course, as I was doing my research. And as I was reading these crypto-Jewish accounts, I decided that there was something perhaps even more happening, something that I call empathetic memory, in which the memory work that I was seeing transcended multidirectional memory. It not only viewed crypto-Jewish history within a communal landscape, but these New Mexican crypto-Jews were personally adopting other communities' traumas and sort of embodying and internalizing a sort of heterogeneous intercultural realm of suffering. And again, it's a tricky line to traverse, and I've thought about this in the year and a half since I wrote this thesis in new ways, and I'm complicating it as I go. But because this is sort of familial, and the consequences and intentions are internal and have the purpose of, or are necessary in the creation of a collective identity that is otherwise fragmented. I view this not as this act of empathetic memory, not as distortive, but as empowering, and even as sort of a model for how perhaps we can approach empathy as we consider the traumas of our sort of inheritance. And I say that, of course, recognizing the danger of historical analogy and the difficulties that I'm going to quote Robin Kelly, who was just cited in an article on exactly this, empathy and analogy, who says that non-discerning empathy can be dangerous in its, quote, intimate identification with individuals or groups that stand in for all or stand in for reason or critical analysis or ethics. So, of course, the Holocaust example is difficult because the Holocaust has stood for so long as this epitome of evil versus good, of genocide. And this would perhaps take me on different routes, but it's a tricky subject. And my thesis argues that this empathetic memory is really valuable. This sort of borrowing of collective memory is both valuable and necessary, as it sort of lessens the distance between disparate communities. It creates a more generous memory landscape. It assists crypto-Jewish memory in that it situates it in sort of a larger Jewish memory. But I say all this also with the consciousness that analogy must be done carefully. And historical analogy may be done by a historian with the aim of rewriting the past or rewriting the present or future. I think contextualization is really important, and preserving sort of disparate events as disparate. But again, I think there's something different going on in this instance in which this empathetic memory exists in memory, sort of in oral transmitted identity.
I think it's a very important idea, and I'm definitely curious to learn more about it myself, so thank you for speaking about it. Just before we move into the last part of the interview, where I'm very interested in asking you about your poetry as well, which I think is a very interesting line of inquiry for me to ask you about, I just want to ask a question quickly about scales of analysis, because I think your work is so interesting because it traverses these different scales of analysis from this kind of very micro, intimate perspective with familial memories and oral histories, then all the way up to the transnational and even the global. In one perspective, in the physical movement of conversos and nuevos cristianos to the new world, but then also, in a sense, even multidirectional memory, in a sense, can be considered transregional or global in kind of linking different experiences of trauma. So I was curious, what do you believe is the importance of studying crypto-Jews in global history at that scale of analysis? And then why do you think it's important to be really conscious about the different geographic scales from the very intimate to the very global in asking these sorts of questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's see. I guess I would say one of the reasons crypto-Judaism in New Mexico was so fascinating to me is because these trends of empathetic memory, of searching for coherence in one's sort of skeletal membrane of inheritance, cannot be distinct to New Mexico crypto Jews. And I won't reveal anything by trying to name others, and I'm partially interested in finding others, other communities affected by diaspora, affected by colonization, who are both the oppressor and the oppressed, and who are left with these fragments and wondering what to do with them. So in that way, this idea of crypto-Jewish memory is extremely global in what it forgets and what it remembers. Because a lot of what is transmitted is sort of this internal, domestic, religious and ritualistic information. And often what's left out is sort of this global contextualization of colonization and of movement from Mexico to New Mexico and displacement of Native peoples. So in that sense, it's a very global example of communities forming and collective memories forming in exile, in diaspora, alongside displacement as sort of global lines are traversed and as one community is brought onto the land of another. So that's not a whole answer, but it's maybe a part of an answer to that great question.
Thank you. No, I think it is a whole answer. And I think you're right. It is so important to think about how can we bring the intimate, the domestic, the local, the familial into these broader trends? And equally, how can we make sure that global history isn't just kind of lacking in humanity? Because I think that's quite important. So now in this last part of the interview, I'd briefly like to ask you a bit about another work which you recently published, I believe, this summer or the spring, perhaps this summer, called Translating History, in which you speak about a new poetry collection that you were kind of writing over the past few years, or specifically while you were in New Mexico over the last year. And you were talking about this interplay between your poetry writing and historical practice. And I think you ask this really fascinating question, which is in your title, of course, which is how can the poetic line
translate history. And I believe in the sense you do look at historical poetry, but I believe you are talking about kind of your own poetry and the contemporary poetry. So what do you mean by translation here? And how have you been able to entwine the writing of poetry as a translating tool for doing history in your own life?
Yeah, so I really began from childhood as someone interested in English and literature and poetry and language, and came to history much later. And so poetry sort of definitely stands at the core of my existence as a person and also my interests in how the world functions, namely through the word, through the line. So there's one very logistical explanation to the project, which is that as I'm in the archive extracting materials for a historical work, what I'm, my instinct is to extract language, to extract words and phrases and repetitions and oddities and colors and all the beautiful things that I find, for example, in Inquisition records. And by beautiful, I, of course, that's a loaded, I mean it with every aspect of the word. And so by translating history, I wanted, as I was in the archive and turning the documents in front of me, both into historical material and into poetic material and literally poetry, as I wrote this sort of collection of archival and historical poetry, I was thinking about what the media of poetry can capture from the archive, from the historical record, that historiography and perhaps even prose, creative prose, cannot. And so I was thinking about sort of the materiality of history, how the poetic line can capture that materiality as memory is often held within the image, and the poem is often an image or relies on image across the whole canon of poetics that exists. How it could embrace sort of the sensorial, the strange that's in the archive, which often has to maybe get touched on, but sort of sifted out of historical work as threads appear. And also along that line, hold conflicting narratives of the archive and sort of bring to bear lost voices, put those voices next to each other. And I think thinking about what we were just talking about with historical analogy, some of the trickiness of writing about historical analogy or of comparative history in general that we face as historians, I think poetry actually sort of soothes in that the poetic line is used to creating juxtapositions and creating incoherences and coherences simultaneously. And it's used to putting things side by side that do not have a direct relationship to one another and cannot be explained in any sort of linear way. So poetry, I found, could sort of invoke comparison without comparing, without dwelling in that act, and sort of could hold those multifocal lines which emerged from the archive for me. So it's been very, both for me as a poet and historian, and I'll say one before the other, but, you know, we'll see. It's a place for me to put the things in the archive that I can't yet really figure out how to put into the historical work. But also it's become an academic interest of what poetry as a medium. There's been a lot of work done on the historical novel, like Lukács, just as one example. But what can the historical poem, what's the history of the historical poem, and what can the historical poem translate of the past, bring from past to present, that other medium perhaps cannot?
I think that's absolutely fascinating and just a really beautiful kind of exposition on your work in these kind of two intertwined fields. And before I wrap up the interview and ask you one last reflective question, I was wondering if you would feel comfortable maybe sharing one of these historical poems, perhaps one that was particularly pertinent to what we were talking about. I know you have many, and I was wondering if there was one in particular that may have come to mind.
Yes. Let's see. Maybe I will read a poem which was published. The translating history article was prose, with some of the poems from my collection inside of it. So maybe I'll read a poem called Observant Maranos, and I'll give a little bit of historical context, which the article gives. So one of the most fascinating pieces I came across in New York City, in Manhattan, was this pamphlet from 1944 published by the American Friends of the Mexican Indian Jews, a sort of charitable organization, which I explore in my chapter on sort of colonialist, nostalgic 20th century texts, of which there are many written about the Marrano communities in Mexico. And in this pamphlet, a visitor who remains anonymous to the Marranos, and I should mention Marrano is a derogatory word for crypto Jews, which descends from the word pig. And of course, pigs are not kosher and have connotations dating back to the Inquisition. So this visitor writes that the community feels a connection to Jewish tradition because of the call of the blood, quote, deep-seated in their souls. So I wanted to write a poem that would sort of interrogate that phrase, the author's simultaneous empathy and profound sense of sort of Orientalist superiority. And this poem is a very good example, I think, of the ways in which I wanted to draw from this sort of incantatory, repetitive language of the Inquisition trials, which I found so compelling, and sort of the formal qualities of the text I was looking at. So it is called Observant Marranos. The call of the blood, you say, and I nod my head, the fall of the blood. But no, you say, the call of the blood. And I nod my head and say, yes, I hear the flowing of blood. And you scream to me, the calling of blood. And I call to you, the mud. It is falling, blood is failing, all is crawling. And you run off and leave me with this language. The call of mud, the suds we use to wipe clean this blood of the past or this blood of desire. For either we wish for clean blood, purity of hand to foot to race, or we remember the weaving of desire with kind, the desire for a kind, for boxes filled with a kind, two kinds at most. The Marranos feel the call of blood back to their people, but aren't they Jews from the start? Yes, the pamphlet says, and no, the author inside and without, a friend and afraid, a cautious touch to those who sing the same songs. Lord of us all, or brown skin, he wonders to himself as he writes to kings and queens for purses of gold.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. I did read it when I read your article, but it's something quite... You're right, the incantatory rhetoric, as you call it, of these documents, it really... I think it really comes through when you speak it as opposed to read it. Well, I suppose in addition to reading it, I suppose it comes out in a different way when you speak it. And there's a lot to think about there, so thank you. So I'd just like to end with one last reflective question, which is kind of thinking about our present moment, which is a time of great change, and there's a lot of debates going on in many quarters about various aspects of our society. And I'd like to end by asking you, what responsibilities do you believe that historians and poets, and perhaps historian poets historian poets together as a kind of combined thing, as in your case, what do you believe historians and poets, what responsibilities do you think they have or we have in studying and writing about memory of marginalized communities and past injustices? And I suppose, finally, what kind of potential do you believe that history and poetry, separately or perhaps even together, have in reshaping our world for the better?
Yeah, I mean, an important question, and definitely one that I'm hoping to sort of keep at the forefront of my mind as I pursue graduate work, because I think it should be guiding the work. I think it's a huge responsibility to be sort of translating oppressed voices of the past who cannot sort of translate themselves because they are of the 15th century or of the 16th century. And of course, descendants can transmit stories of ancestors, but that's not always possible either. So I definitely feel the responsibility of holding voices and figuring out what to do with them. And I think what I'm ultimately and very optimistically aiming to do is sort of reframe these categories of mythology and nostalgia and memory and history as a way of rewriting and sort of rupturing narratives, of realigning voices, of allowing voices to surface within frameworks that they haven't been able to surface within in the past. And then, of course, I have, as a poet, you have to believe in the power of art. to shape culture, and especially working with memory to shape cultural memory. Of course, we're seeing the power of memorials, the harm of memorials in Confederate monuments in America now. So the idea that text can be a power in shaping cultural memory and shaping our relationship to the past, with a very conscientious, and I think it's important today to make it explicit with this desire and impetus that understanding of the past will help us in the present in tangible material ways in changing the society that we live in.
Well, I think that's very well said, and I think a good note to end on. So thank you so much for speaking with me, Rachel. I look forward to beginning graduate school with you soon. I'm not sure when this interview will be posted, but thank you so much for speaking about some of these beautiful but also very painful and difficult topics. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here, and I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of your readings and your questions and your attention and the wonderfulness of the project that you're doing. So thank you for including me.
Thank you for listening to this 18th episode of the Global History Podcast with Rachel Kaufman. As always, if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And last but not least, stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.